Welcome to Season 5 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast created and produced by medical students at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we explore ideas in medicine you can't always find in a textbook, from navigating medical education to exploring humanism in medicine and developing our physician identities. We hope there's something for everyone.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email, on Instagram, or on Twitter at unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy.
Hey everyone, this is Sarah, here to welcome you to a fabulous episode with Dr. Rana Adish. Dr. Adish is the author of In Shock, a critically acclaimed, best-selling memoir based on her own critical illness. She's a pulmonary and critical care physician currently practicing at Henry Ford Hospital, where she's integrated compassionate communication strategies and narrative medicine practice into their curriculum. Her accolades are numerous and her heart is pure gold. Listen to this episode and pick up a copy of her memoir at a library near you. Well, welcome, Dr. Adish, to Unscripted Medicine. We're very excited to have you. If you could tell the audience a bit about yourself and how you came to write your memoir In Shock, which is how I have heard of you.
So, thank you for having me. I am a pulmonary and critical care physician. I work at Henry Ford Health in Detroit, Michigan. I run our pulmonary hypertension program and I'm medical director of care experience. So I have some responsibility for how our patients are cared for from a communication and emotional standpoint, and also how we care for our providers. I wrote In Shock after I started teaching our communications program. I found myself telling the students in the class why this work was so important to me. And I thought that if I wrote about it, I could just hand it to them and I wouldn't have to explain it every time. And it turned into a little bit bigger of a project than that. So my motivation for writing it was that at the very end of my fellowship training in pulmonary and critical care, I got very ill myself. And I really saw medicine from the other side of the bed. And it was an education that was so illuminating for me in so many ways that I just needed to process it, for one, through writing, and also share some of the things I learned because I found that they were just so absent in our training. So I was 7 months pregnant. It was literally my last day. And I just had this really acute onset of abdominal pain that I would find out later was a hepatic adenoma in my liver that burst. And so I effectively bled to death. Within the first few hours, I went into multi-system organ failure. My kidneys and liver, and ended up on a ventilator. Was in refractory hemorrhagic shock, having my blood replaced multiple times. And that experience of going from like a doctor 1 second to a patient the next, was so wild because I saw things that I didn't think twice about when I was on the doctor side, like how in the operating room, an anesthesiologist would say, "We're losing her. She's circling the drain." You know, I'd been in rooms like that. I knew that you said those things to try to get a sense of urgency in your team, to get them to move quicker, to understand the acuity. But to hear it as a patient, my goodness, it really landed differently. And, you know, that first night turned into a very long recovery and multiple surgeries and sequela of that first night. So the learning really continued in a way that let me see our culture differently. And I felt like that would be worth writing about.
Absolutely. That's a tremendous story, and something you're right that until you're the patient, it's probably very hard to put yourself in their shoes as much as we try as learning students and as providers. And then writing about it, I didn't realize you taught a communications course. That's neat. Do you still do that?
Yeah, it's called Clear Communications. It's really some of the most meaningful work I do. So the first thing that I realized, you know, when I was going to go back to work was I didn't think I had the skills I needed to communicate in the way I had needed to be communicated with as a patient. I just didn't think I'd ever been taught it in the 14 years of undergrad, grad, med school, residency, fellowship. We had 0 minutes of communication training. And so I sought out Vital Talk, which is in Pittsburgh. And I took the courses as a learner. And I saw the value in it. And there were other people at our organization who had also taken classes, the palliative care people. And so we started teaching it together. And it's been really practice changing for me, because it offers you a kind of roadmap for difficult conversations. And it just seems absolutely critical that we understand that these conversations have the same potential to do harm as a procedure that goes bad or a surgery that has a complication. You know, our communication has just as much potential to injure, and we don't always think about it that way. So being intentional about it, giving trainees the skills they need to do it well, is really important to me.
Do you find that you have certain trainees in certain programs who benefit more, or are you trying to integrate it across your hospital system?
When we started, we focused on the groups that we knew needed it the most because of the acuity of their conversation. So critical care, palliative care, oncology, emergency medicine. And we trained the faculty too, because we knew that if we just train the learners and they didn't see it modeled to them at the bedside, that it would just be another thing that you learned in a classroom, but wasn't real, you know? So we've been very fortunate to have good uptake with senior faculty who then can go on to be facilitators as well. And it's kind of this generative process. Now it's part of the institutional curriculum. So all of the incoming residents are trained. It just feels foundational, you know, the same way you learn acid base or you learn anatomy. It's just foundational. And so I can't speak to how it's deployed after they leave us. I think we get a lot of feedback that it's helpful. And I hope that it helps. For me, it's brought me more joy in work. It's brought me more of a sense of efficacy in my conversations. I find I don't avoid hard things in the way that maybe I used to. And I hope that it's the same for them.
That's really neat.
Thanks.
I want to do something like that someday, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. And I hope you find that other institutions also value it. You know, it sounds like you started in Pittsburgh maybe with your training. So it does seem pretty universal, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that education piece is something I wanted to talk to you about, because like you said, you had an acute illness when you were probably at the most educated book-wise of your whole career.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit, and you have started, but can you speak more on how being sick challenged the education that you had had up to that point?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Part of why I went into critical care was, honestly, I loved the science, the medicine-iness of it, how patients were managed with like ventilators and pressors. It was just like all these things you were applying to the patient. And I really felt like my role as a physician was just to shorten the distance between illness and recovery. And to do it with all of that technology and all of that science and all of the knowledge I had gained, I just needed to shorten the distance for them. And that was my purpose and what I worked hard to do. I didn't understand that that's treatment, but it's not healing. I think without attending to some of the suffering that's happening in that space, the very real emotional aspects of the care, without a relational aspect to the care. When I was a patient, it just felt like there was something missing, right? And it really disrupted my idea of what it means to be a healer. I would have physicians who could speak very eloquently about what was going on in the chart version of me, my labs, my imaging, but have no idea actually what was going on with me, the person in the bed. And that dichotomy, them treating the patient who lived in the computer and not treating me, was really something I was acutely aware of as a patient. Whereas a physician, I never noticed it. I shamefully could round on a patient, you know, in the hallway outside of their room, look at this secondhand story, all of their labs, all of their imaging, and come up with a plan that I thought was a good plan without ever meeting the person. And that just feels bananas to me now, that I wouldn't have integrated who they are as a human, what their hopes are, what their wishes are, what their family is, like none of it. So that was a real disruptor for me. And what I knew was that as physicians, we were avoiding some of those hard spaces because it was uncomfortable and because we defined our role as fixers. And we really didn't think we had value if we weren't fixing something. We didn't believe that just sitting with someone who was suffering meant anything. And I think part of that is because it makes us feel useless because of the way we see ourselves. And so I had to really accept that some of the most healing moments for me were not treatment moments. They were moments when people were able to sit in my experience with me and just be present for it with whatever tools they had. Sometimes it was just listening. Sometimes it was physical presence and touch. Sometimes it was reflective listening. But that changed my idea of what my patients might need from me.
I just could listen to you all day. I think I'm learning a lot of good things.
I'm so glad.
You speak in your book as a patient about the loss of comfort, dignity, and control. Mm-hmm. Do you find, as a patient in your own institution, that made a difference? Or do you think, as a patient anywhere, people experience that?
I think the patient experience anywhere is one of being de-identified, you know, being made to sort of fall into this generic category where you're unique intersectional identity is sort of left at home, and you know, you're put in a gown like everyone else in a hospital bed, and you're under the control of a group of people. There isn't privacy, which makes dignity hard. There's just a kind of de-identification and depersonalization that happens with that transition. As much as we try, I think, in medicine to bring in pieces of the person, it's always just that. It's always pieces. I don't think we, as a field, have learned how to hold the whole person in all of their complexity. Narrative medicine, I think, gets close to that, where, you know, the field that was really begun by Rita Sharon, who really takes a look at the words that we use, the words the patient uses, understanding not just what is said, but the meaning behind the words and decoding it and really trying to get to know people at a different level. But medicine for so long hasn't cared about any of that. And so I feel like we're building it back in. But in the meantime, the patients are a little bit left behind.
Do you see something like patient-centered rounding being an advantage?
I do. I think any time we can center the patient and the family in the care, it's an improvement on where we've been. Medicine as a structure is built around the physicians. And, you know, we're sort of chipping at it, but we're not rebuilding it in the image of the patient. And I don't even know that we let ourselves dream enough about what it could look like if it was truly patient-centered care. I'm proud that we have patient and family advisory councils now integrated in health systems. I appreciate taking, you know, a patient experience and putting it into our communication curriculum so that we don't make the same mistakes. But it does feel like we're chipping away at a problem instead of reimagining what it could be.
I think a lot of the technology advancement is also a challenge, right? And I was shadowing yesterday and the physicians and the residents were on the computer more than they were looking at the patient. And it's not that they weren't engaged, just that the burden of all the charting is so high that they would, you know, work all night.
It's changed medicine in a way that I don't know that we've fully acknowledged, the integration of an electronic medical record. And, you know, tending to that patient is very different than tending to the actual patient. But no one forces you to tend to the actual patient, whereas the electronic medical record will ding at you and alarm and demand your attention, and the billers will look there, and the, you know, all of it's happening in the chart. And so that's why I feel so strongly that we have to preserve that sort of sacred space with the patient, because it's the only thing that won't scream at you, and you'll see it. Your time will feel so compressed that to be efficient, sometimes you just do the thing that needs to be done, but it won't nurture you in the way that actually having a relational experience with the patient that feels healing, where you feel like you're, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I thought being a doctor was. No one sits in front of a computer and says, this is what I thought being a doctor was. No one says, that was such a nourishing note. I have so much joy and purpose and fulfillment because of how beautiful my assessment and plan were. But, you know, having a conversation with the family and talking to them about their experience of illness, man, does that like make you feel like you're right where you need to be? So we have to preserve that. No one will scream at us to do it.
I just keep thinking, if anybody's listening and has some novel ideas, we'd love to hear them, because you're so right. I think that's the biggest challenge I see as a barrier to direct patient care in my career and what my career will look like.
And I think AI will honestly disrupt that. I think our notes are going to be generated soon, just through active listening through AI. We already have pilots that are happening that will do that. But it won't force us to do the things that are generative. It's just a solution to one aspect of the problem.
Hmm. Another thing I'm curious about in your illness and recovery that you wrote about in your book is being a physician and a patient, because that's where a lot of our listeners are headed, is primarily physicians. And then maybe one day, unfortunately, they'll be in a patient role. You talked about a resident who was asking you about your own scans as he was doing them. I mean, it shocked me, but at the same time, I could see where the learner was coming from. Mm-hmm. How did you navigate being a physician and a patient at the same time, or being a physician, but primarily a patient?
It's interesting. That resident, when I started writing the book, I was still pretty mad at him. I had some unresolved anger, you might say, about the way that I felt like I was put in a situation that wasn't appropriate as a patient. To have to explain, you know, my own OB scan felt hurtful. There were other instances where he would come and tell me what a bad night it was for him the night that, you know, I had died. And I felt like that was a kind of violation. And then the magic of reflection and time and processing and writing, I came to have so much compassion for him at every step of that, because I saw the ways that we don't build safe spaces for trainees to say they don't know something. We don't build safe spaces for trainees to reflect if they've chosen a career that doesn't feel like a good fit for them. There's so much fear. There's so much burden of student loan debt and fear of failure. Medicine attracts people who are very used to being perfect, and that can be very hard. And so it was interesting as an exercise because I found so much compassion, and that ended up translating into self-compassion that I could sort of have a gentler lens on myself as well, not only as a patient, because I think there were times I was not a very good patient at all, but also as a physician. You sort of believe that you have to be perfect. There's something about medicine where it's so high stakes, and you're trained in a way that makes you know that if you make a mistake, people can die. And so it feels very fraught. And going through this process of reflection and writing, I saw that our patients actually do not expect us to be perfect. They expect us to be human. And releasing some of that expectation and being more honest about what it takes to care for each other, to care for patients, to be a patient, that there was actually a lot of mercy in that humility, you know?
Right. I think as you're talking about how I'm a second year med student studying for boards right now and, you know, thinking about, okay, I start my third year in less than a month or so. How, as a medical student with a limited experience being with patients, taking care of patients, do I best learn how to take care of them, right? When I show up, you know, my first day of third year, what advice would you have for how I approach patient care?
I think you're going to see a lot of examples as you go through your clinical rotations and even as you're in residency training of ways that we've become dysfunctional. And my hope is that you hold on to what you know to be true and don't adapt to some of our dysfunction. So you already know that, like, the patient matters and their story matters and attending to the patient in the bed matters, but you'll get pulled in a lot of different directions. And every time I have a medical student on my service, their earnestness about the patient and family, their willingness to spend time talking to them, recalibrates my own awareness of those things. They serve as a kind of model for our idealism and what we had hoped medicine would look like. So in a weird way, you already have all of the tools you need to succeed. You just need to hold on to them so that we can emulate them better.
That's an interesting perspective. I have an honest question for you, mm-hmm. because I loved this quote from your book, because this happens to me all the time. Mm-hmm. You said every listener hears a different story. The fact that she shares something different with her nurse than what she tells you and me is to be expected. Why does this happen, do you think? And how can we, as students, really get the accurate story?
So the word accurate is interesting, because what is the accurate story, right? Is there really any one true version of anything. It's all perspective. And as a student, I used to feel like I had failed if an attending got a different story, or even a co-resident got a different piece of data. I used to feel that somehow I was not as effective in my clinical interview because I hadn't elicited that same response. But what I learned was really that it's how we listen that determines what someone is willing to share with us. And so my obligation is to be the best listener I can be so that someone feels safe enough to tell me difficult things, knows that they can trust me to do with that information the right thing, the ethical thing, the thing with integrity. The only thing I can control is how I arrive at the conversation, that I don't appear distracted, that I am able to receive what they offer me without judgment, and just be a safe space for that. I think if you arrive with that intention, you'll be amazed what people share with you. It's such a privilege, and it always humbles me. But if you think about the most, you know, extreme form on either end, if I'm a woman from a marginalized community who is aware that women with my demographics die more frequently in childbirth, and an elderly white cis hetero male walks in, or someone that I identify with who's in my age group, who shares my identity, my gender, my race, I will tell them different things because they are different spaces. And we all make judgments about that all the time. There are aspects of that we can't control. We can't change who we are, but we can show up to listen differently and hope that that's enough.
You're really speaking to the art of medicine, I think. And I'm sure you're very well versed and well reflected on what the art of medicine is based on even this conversation so far.
I think that that's where the magic is. You know, like the science is what gives you a portal into the places that are magic. But the magic's on the other side.
That's awesome. That's the whole reason I've done 2 years of med school, to just keep going.
Yeah.
Yes. I wanted to transition a bit to some communication techniques you've gained for critically ill patients as a provider and in your own experiences. Are there things that come to mind as maybe some do's or some don'ts for critically ill patients and their families?
Yeah, the first thing that my experience changed for me was just an awareness of my language around patients. I had sort of neglected attending to that before my experience, which, you know, I shouldn't have, but I did. So just assuming that the patient and family can hear everything all the time, and that the way we sign out to each other reflects our judgments about our patients, and what we say about them matters, and to do it with respect and not ever say something that you wouldn't say in their presence. I think that is just a simple etiquette rule. But the smaller things are things like asking permission. You know, doctors have this habit of just feeling entitled to whatever information or physical exam that they want to do when they walk into the room. And just the simple act of saying, "Would it be all right if I ask you a few questions about what brought you in?" can kind of redistribute some power to a patient who might not have any in that moment. Even asking permission before you give serious news. You know, "I wanted to talk about your scan, but I wonder, would that be okay? Is there someone you'd like to have here to listen as well? Should we do it later?" All of these things are really about redistributing power in a profession that has hoarded it for a very long time. I had to learn to, so you spend the 2 years that you've just spent learning all of the Latin terms and the medical jargon, and then you go into a patient room and you don't use it, right? You have to translate it back. So my husband's had this like headache that's on half of his head that's constant. And he went to the neurologist, and the neurologist is like, you have hemicranium continuum. And he's like, half my head hurts all the time. Yep, that's totally what I just said to you. And so it's funny to me that we like translate and then revert, but just not using medical jargon for patients, speaking simply and the way that you would talk to anybody helps with really understanding, right? Like good communication means it's understood. And so to ask a teach back question is something that we practice. Could you tell me, so that I can check that my own communication was effective? Could you tell me how you might explain this to your wife when you go home? To ask that with humility because you want to get better is a very different thing than quizzing the patient. And that's something that I've practiced that's helped me. But really, it's all about honoring the person in front of you and being kind of humble about it.
It sounds like that's for good news and for challenging news, right?
Yeah. I think we lose sight sometimes of what is difficult news for a patient. You know, just a lab value getting worse, just having to stay an extra day in the hospital, just needing antibiotics that upset your stomach. Like, it's all kind of hard news. And we have such a distorted scale that we don't always recognize what is hard news for a patient. And we don't give it the same level of respect we might if we knew in our heart it was bad news, but it's all relative.
That's so interesting. I can think of instances where, you know, family member will say something, or I hear a patient say something and I think, whoa, and you know, to them, okay, like whatever.
Yeah.
So it's reframing the context, I guess.
Yeah.
I like that. Another, I think you borrowed this phrase from another person, but comfort in and dump out, you bring up in your book. Can you explain to our listeners what that is about?
Yeah, there was a wonderful article, I think it was in the LA Times, by Susan Silk and Barry Goldwater, that described the ring theory, which is really an etiquette lesson in times of suffering. And what it describes is a series of circumferential rings where at the center of the ring is the person who is most impacted by anything, the trauma, the illness, the death. The next circle out from that person is other people who are directly impacted, maybe spouses, children, close family. And then further out, less close family, friends, acquaintances, work colleagues, looky-loos. And the only rule for this is that you assess where the person you're talking to lies within this ring. Are they closer to the center than you are, or are they further out? And if they're closer to the center, even if you're impacted by it, that's someone you should comfort and not dump your experience of the situation onto. If it's someone who's further out from you and they have the bandwidth to hold it, then by all means, you can complain. This was something that came up for me when that poor resident came into my room to say what a terrible night it had been for him. And I remember thinking that, like, wow, am I really the person you should be complaining about that? Like, here I am, like, still bloodied and like basically dead. And my husband just wanted to punch him. Like, he could not understand where that was coming from. And so when I found this, it helped me to reframe why I had found it so difficult to accept his assertion that it had been a terrible night for him, and over time to find some compassion for him.
That's neat. I've never heard of it before you mentioned it. And so I think that's an interesting strategy to just sort of say, where are we? What are we doing? And who's the patient, and who cares about the patient, and who cares about you in a different space, right?
And I still mess this up. I can, you know, just recently I remember telling a patient, you really scared me. I was really worried about you last night. And I heard it like in that meta way where you're listening to yourself and you're like, oh, right. No, I'm centering this on myself. And I had to stop and say, I'm sorry. That came out wrong. What I really meant to say was the whole team was working really hard in the hopes that you'd be better today. And I'm glad to see that you are.
So that's a reframe.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, saying you were wrong. I think that's something we don't do enough. But you know when you've said something that lands poorly and your patient knows. So pretending it didn't happen doesn't really serve anyone.
I bet. As we sort of wind down some of this interview, how do we express our emotions then as human beings, as providers, but as human beings around critically sick patients? Something you've been on both sides of.
Yeah, they're just honestly acknowledging that we have emotions about these things is new in medicine. For a long time, the teaching was just that you were above it. You were clinically distant and removed from the emotional situation that was happening for the patient and family. And so it's already a step ahead to say what happens to this person impacts me personally, and I have feelings about it, and they're worthy of being articulated and processed. There are many different ways to do that. And I think it's one of those things where there isn't one right way. What's good for someone won't work for somebody else. And the most important thing is that you work to find the thing that works for you. For some people, it's as simple, like I have a friend who can just text me and say, I need to vent. And she will vent for 5 minutes and she'll be like, okay, I'm fine. And that works for her. For me, I spend 10 years reflecting and writing and processing and speaking. I have other friends who can go for a run and they are reset to their baseline and they are good. If something happens on that run where they leave it behind. If I'm running, there's probably a fire. Like it's not going to help me do anything. So what I would encourage people is just acknowledge the emotions that rise up in you. Don't try to suppress them. Try to give them a name, even if it's hard at first, even if it's, you know, I feel ashamed that I couldn't save that person. Find your safe space where you can say those things out loud, even if that's the page and not a person. Find a way to externalize them, because it's when we keep them trapped that I think they start to do damage and build up.
It goes along, it sounds like, with what you write about suffering and being present with suffering and transforming who we are by that suffering and holding the suffering of others. Is that something you learned in training, or is that something you learned after?
No, I don't know that I learned it in training. I think I avoided suffering as much as possible until I felt like I had developed a capacity for it. And capacity is a funny thing, because you can't necessarily just build it intentionally in a day. It comes with time. But trusting yourself not to break in the presence of someone else's suffering is something that I think we can all work towards. And the more we develop skills to care for ourselves, the more we'll trust ourselves. Like the communication training was the first step in that. To be like, I know I can sit in any conversation, and however hard it is, I'll have something I can say that won't hurt the person and might even help. That was the first step. And then having those conversations and gaining that fluency and seeing it work improved my confidence. And then having people say, you know, it's always a surreal experience when someone dies and the family thanks you. Because as a physician, you think, oh my gosh, I totally failed. You have all sorts of self-negating thoughts about your own worthlessness. And then the family tells you that what you did mattered, and you realize that all you did was listen and be present for a hard thing and create a safe container for their grief. And so then you start to value it because they show you it's valuable. And so it's kind of this iterative cycle of building your capacity. So attuning to that, attuning to those moments where you feel that it helped can be a big step in that direction.
Yeah, I imagine what that could look like as a student, you know, in the next couple of years, or someone graduating and starting residency, or graduating residency and caring for patients all on your own, you know, the adaptivity that we really do have as people. Mm-hmm. And the gift that we can give is just listening. It sounds like that's really where you're coming from with a lot of what you have tried to be as a physician.
Yeah, if you think about, you know, if you have a hard day, and you call a friend, that friend can't unsad you. They can't, they don't have anything they can do to fix what happened during your day. But somehow when you get off the phone, you feel better. You know, you talked it through, someone listened, they were there for you, you feel supported. And that's something we devalue in medicine, but I think it's infinitely valuable.
Hmm. I think it's something to look for in programs and in institutions, right, is how physicians take care of each other and other staff and, you know, the receptivity that patients have, for sure. As we finish here, is there anything you would have told yourself as a learner that you wish you knew then, but you know now?
I think it is what I tell students even now, which is to look for the moments that really shimmer for you, because you're going to have a lot of value judgments that come at you about what's prestigious or what's a fellowship that's worth aspiring to or what careers are valued differently than others. And they may not align with where you feel joy or where you feel purpose. And the only way to build a career that really will give you longevity and joy in work is if you attune to those moments where you feel fulfilled and build more of them into your day. Things like educating a family about a condition, things like having a clinic encounter with a patient where they're able to share what an experience has been like for them. There are things that we don't esteem the way we esteem procedures, but that's the only way to really find that Venn diagram where, like, what you love and what medicine needs overlap is if you pay attention to where you feel alive.
That's great advice. Thank you, Dr. Adish, for your time, for speaking with us, and hopefully the people listening have some ideas on how to be better physicians in the future.
I enjoyed it a lot, Sarah. Thank you for your questions.